You're listening to a 95BFM podcast.
Cities in Aotearoa need improvement. The voices shaping them need greater diversity, urban design needs rethinking, and people's expectations around living needs to change. Urban Advisory is a group aimed at implementing this change by bringing together different areas affecting the development of cities to effect real significant change in how we shape our urban centres. News director Lillian spoke to Greer O'Donnell from the Urban Advisory, beginning by asking about what the group does.
So the Urban Advisory was born out of Natalie Allen and her, I guess, disquiet with the way the current profession works. So when she finished her PhD, she went to get a job and didn't find anywhere that really would utilise her skills and the way that she thought about the built environment. And so then she had been working by herself for a couple of years, and I had recently moved to Auckland and a mutual friend introduced us and we got chatting, and then we decided that our views about how we should build cities and how we should make more inclusive cities and cities that were good for everybody sort of spiralled into us deciding to be business partners and building the Urban Advisory from there.
And what is the disquiet that she felt about? What, you know, what is it? What are the issues that guys see with the cities?
Oh, well, there's many. So with cities, there has come, you know, great achievement for human civilization, but there has also, unfortunately, created a lot of inequity and a lot of bad outcomes. You only need to look at the mental health statistics globally to know that we're not doing something right. And the divide between the haves and the have-nots is getting bigger and bigger. And unfortunately, by putting people together in agglomerated areas like cities do, it comes with heaps of environmental challenges and social challenges. On the other side of the disquiet question was around how our industry works currently. That's the built environment industry. And it has traditionally been a very linear approach to the way that we think about and develop cities. So we have specific professions come along sort of one step at a time, and we have the planning system, and then the surveyors come along, and then the engineers come along, then the architects come along, and then they kind of slot in people at the end. How we view cities is much more circular, and we sort of actually think that they need to start with people because that's who we're building them for. And so not only do we aim to have a more circular approach to all the professional services that you need to create cities, but that we actually incorporate the residents into that process right from the beginning.
So is there also, I mean, you said the building industry process, well, it's the industry itself, right? There's an issue at the start line,
yeah.
Basically. Is this also an issue around the representation in the positions of those people making the decisions?
Absolutely. So yesterday I spoke to the Government Land Organisations Conference, which was all the chief executives and directors and chairmen of the government land organisations in New Zealand and Australia. And out of 25 people present in the room, there was 3 women, and I was the only person that would have been under the age of 55. And so we have people in the position of power who are making decisions that have a certain worldview, and unfortunately, that's not producing the best outcomes for the people who actually live in our city.
Are we also talking like Māori, Pacifica voices, migrant voices, refugee, you know, we're talking
everybody's
everyone.
Voices. So in the way that we engage with our communities in consultation processes, for example, it's very biased towards a few squeaky wheels. And so it's really hard to elicit meaningful contributions from a diverse representative, like a segment of society. And often the way we design buildings and spaces actually doesn't even ask the people initially, like we consult, but it's a very box ticking exercise as opposed to really trying to understand what people need and how we can provide those things. I mean, that's not to say that everything is bad, and we are improving, and there are some, you know, great initiatives that do get communities involved, and there's new developments out west South Auckland where the developer is really trying to create community and get those people to be participating in that process well before the houses are even built. But we've just got a long way to go. I get told off for being really critical of the environment, and I guess I do acknowledge that there's lots of hard work, and it's not necessarily the profession's fault. It's just the way that it has evolved over time, and there is many processes that are a result of the system, and that's our capitalist society system, you know, like when you go back to the base of it. And so it's pretty hard to create
colonial
change.
Maybe.
Yeah, absolutely, exactly. And colonialism and capitalism and globalisation, they're all sort of interrelated, and they are a direct contributor to the social injustice and the inequality that we see.
So what is it that the Urban Advisory Group does kind of at every step of the way in terms of trying to change that?
Yeah, so we're urban strategists. So we kind of made that up. It exists overseas, but in New Zealand it's quite a new field. And what we do is try to integrate all the perspectives. So we work across scale. So we do research for the National Building Association of New Zealand, for example, which is around understanding how to create medium density housing that's actually livable and enhances well-being. So that's at the sort of city scale. And then we would work with councils or government land organisations such as HLC, which is the Homes, Land, Community, on strategies for specific precincts and neighbourhoods, and how to incorporate all the different perspectives and views, as well as all the actual implementation requirements of planning rules and the actual physical aspects of how you develop or regenerate urban neighbourhoods. And then we work right down to the project scale with specific community groups who want to advance a project. And we only kind of work with the people that in the projects that have a desire to actually affect positive change. So generally, development is built on this sort of highest and best use premise, which is about how much money can we make from building on this piece of land. And there are obviously exceptions with the public sector's projects, or often, you know, they do consider social, environmental and wider economic outcomes as well. But generally the private sector development industry is built around creating profit, not outcomes. And again, not necessarily the profession's fault entirely, because the banks, for example, drive that behaviour because they require you to demonstrate that you're going to be making 30% profit, because it's about risk. And so, I mean, this leads quite nicely into a space that we're working a lot on at the moment, which is around alternative development models and how we can promote those in New Zealand, more commonly known as co-housing. And there's a real burgeoning space where residents are standing up and saying, we actually want to lead the development of projects so that they're based around quality and connection between people and not profit. So that's really interesting.
On that point, it was, like I said, my partner's sort of in that field, and it was something that he had brought up. He's not raised here, and he came here, and he's seen this kind of, and that's why I say colonial, because it, you know, when New Zealand was colonised, and there was apparently all of this sort of land available, which I put in quotes, and so there was this kind of drive to just kind of spread out and have as much space as you want. And now we've got this kind of culture, and we're not kind of, we have a culture where everybody wants their own house, their own backyard, but then you also have houses which are like cold, damp and leaky, because also they're all on their, you know, it's just this whole kind of cycle, and it is a cultural thing. So have you found that there is a sort of demand for people to be in co-housing kind of?
Yeah, well, it's really interesting, because as you quite correctly point out, in New Zealand we're very attached to our sort of quarter acre dream backyard, two garage, standalone dwellings. But that is changing, and our lifestyle preferences are changing, and the demand for certain typologies of housing is changing. And that's largely because there's a need, and it has to change because the affordability of housing is just becoming unattainable for many people. But it's also a recognition that we have to build more dense environments because we're running out of space. And most people would look at New Zealand and go, oh, you've got plenty of space, just keep building into the arable land of Pukekohe. However, that comes with a number of risks. So the natural carrying capacity of certain geographical areas like Auckland needs to be understood before we actually continue to just build more and more and more houses and to have urban sprawl. There's always going to be the need for some degree of new neighbourhood development that's not just brownfields or densifying current spaces, because we have a growing population globally. That's something we're always going to have to grapple with. But we can do that better, so we can understand where, from a natural perspective, urban development can be more easily facilitated and actually the environment can host more urban development. And then there's getting into the idea of co-housing. It's actually about sharing spaces and having higher quality, smaller spaces that are perhaps private, and then more higher quality public spaces that can be shared by a larger group of people. And so while in New Zealand it is new and we still have very much entrenched perspectives by many that they want their quarter acre dream and their third bedroom houses, that is changing. And we're actually scoping a piece of research at the moment to unpack future housing demand, because future first home buyers have different preferences to historical home buyers. And we're finding, you know, people, the latest research we did around livability of medium density housing, for example, actually demonstrated that people cared more about location and quality as opposed to size. And that's really interesting, because we know that as we become more urban, people value being able to access the places that they live, work and play within an approximate area instead of having to travel. And people will trade off the larger space for the convenience and the accessibility. But we don't have a lot of data and statistics to support that yet. And so the market keeps producing what the market has always purchased, which are three-bedroom standalone dwellings.
Do you find, like, if you're engaging with communities and you're hearing from them what they want, but in the sort of larger structure of things, are you still finding, I guess, pushback to your ideas and your processes?
Oh, yeah. So we get resistance at every step of the way. But there is also huge, huge support. So we were involved in an event down in Hamilton where over 250 people turned up because they were interested in this. We hosted a very small session in Auckland as a trial, and we had over 400 people approach us wanting to attend. And across New Zealand, there are people already initiating these projects. High Street in Dunedin, the Urban Collective in Wellington, closer developments in Katikati, Bay of Plenty, Ohu development in Christchurch. There's already existing eco-villages, Kotari Village in the Hawke's Bay, Dalyave and Wanganui. So there are pockets of sort of innovation already. However, going back to your question about the resistance, the current framework, legislative framework, financing systems, planning framework, are not set up to support or enable these projects, which is actually why we've set up a incorporated society called the Society for Alternative Development, and that's purely to lobby and advocate for the change that is needed to better enable these projects.
Cool. I have one kind of last question, but is there anything else you wanted to add?
Oh, I've got lots of things I could add, but I guess just as an opportunity to briefly explain alternative development models, there's actually a range of them. Papakāinga is a model that we're hearing more and more about, and that goes back to the Indigenous First Nations people and the way that they actually live, and we're seeing lots of great examples of that. But just as a quick education exercise, because we're on the sort of mission to enable more people to participate in these processes, is that co-housing comes in many different forms. And while some people might be interested in some aspects of it but frightened by other aspects of how communal or commune-like it is, what I would really like to take the opportunity to do is explain to people that you can come in and be involved in varying different levels of
Community?
Community, yes, it's probably the best way to put it. So a property collective, for example, is just a group of people between sort of 3 to 9 who come together to develop, usually townhouse style, on a site. And it becomes about 15 to 20% more affordable than if you went and bought a house. Then there's co-housing proper, which you share facilities and you still own your own title and you still have your own apartment that you access, but you may have shared laundry spaces, shared workshop spaces, shared libraries, shared common kitchen, in addition to your own kitchen unit. But it just means that you can host large parties, which you couldn't do, say, if you were living in an apartment without shared facilities. Some of them have car sharing facilities, shared gardens, maker spaces. Like, there's such a range of different shared amenity that you can include, and there's a varying range of different types of projects. So some have few shared spaces and some have lots. And you can make it fit for purpose for the group of people. The Nightingale model in Australia is really, really popular, and they have waiting lists a mile long. And there's a group in New Zealand looking to set one of those up. Called Next Door, and you can find them on Facebook if you want to sign up for that. And that's more just sort of traditional living, apartment living, but with a more eco-friendly kind of design and a few more community vibe undertones to how the whole development will work, as opposed to a normal development that's more very individualistic. And then there's the sort of furthest along the spectrum, which are property cooperatives. And that's where you actually don't own your own unit or your own title, but you have shares in a cooperative company that owns the entire development. So you still have exclusive use and exclusive rights to your apartment, but it takes it a step further in terms of addressing the affordability issue, because it means the buy-in or the deposit that you need is a very smaller amount, and that actually makes that model the most accessible in terms of the broadest range of people that that could participate.
Yeah.
It also requires a big mind shift for New Zealanders in terms of how we view and perceive ownership of land and property, and so we're working.
That was a 95BFM podcast. To hear more, head to 95BFM.com/bcasts.